at this big book retreat, and from the like the moment of our first conversation, I knew that there was something and that was working in her life, and you know, that to me is her higher power, and she's truly connected. And if you don't believe there are strong women in AA, just look at Jackie, because she's awesome. Okay, and I give you Jackie.
That was kind of intense. I don't know if I can live up to that. My name is Jackie. I'm an alcoholic. I'm really glad to be here. I guess I should say, I like to start out, I'm a recovered alcoholic. And for a long time, when people said, I'm a recovered alcoholic, I thought they were kind of an asshole. I was like, okay, and what am I? You know, I'm just an alcoholic. And you're a recovered alcoholic. And I don't remember where I picked it up. It could have been a treatment. It could have been just something that I picked up, but just something that that I had programmed in my head already. But I had the belief system that you were never recovered, that you were always recovering. And I think that gets tossed around a lot in the rooms. And it wasn't until I got hooked up with a couple different teachers that someone actually took me to several different pages in the book and pointed me to the language where it says, we have recovered, on page 20. We have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. And so today, I don't feel like an asshole standing up here saying that I'm a recovered alcoholic, because I have recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. And it was hopeless in mind and body. My poor husband here is here to support me, and he can attest to it. He's fortunately the only one in the room that can. I like to keep them few and far between. So that's kind of my explanation about recovered. I think that people hear that a lot and, perhaps had the same reaction that I did, with that term and maybe don't understand. And it comes straight from the literature. We have recovered when we go through this work and when we get connected and we go through steps 1 through 11, and then you carry this message and work with other people, and get connected through step 12, and find that connection with a power greater than ourselves, then we have recovered from that hopeless state of mind and body. And you know it when you feel it. And so I feel confident saying that today. You know, someone came up to me before the meeting, they were like, oh, I really know you, but I've never really heard your story. And I was like, my story is probably a lot like your story, you know, I got drunk and then I ended up here. you know, it all does kind of look the same. You know, the substances differ. The situations differ. One thing someone told me a little while ago has changed kind of how I tell my story is that they said, you know, where it says in the big book, what happened, tell what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And someone said, well, what you should really be telling is what you were like, what happened to you, and what you're like now. And that really changed, for me, the way I tell my story. Because for a long time, and again, really the only person that can attest is my poor husband who sat through several of these, but is that my story was a lot about me and war stories, and this is how crazy it was, and then this is what happened, and this is how I got into treatment, and this is how crazy Ridgeview was, and then this is what it's like now, you know, and this is kind of how I'm bumbling around in sobriety now. And now I feel like the way that I tell it is more about really focusing on the fact that alcohol is but a symptom, you know, that that this disease is about selfishness and self-centeredness at our core. And so what I was like before I was self-centered. I was selfish. I was manipulative. I lied. I cheated. I stole. That's what I was like. You know, I think a lot of people say that they're first, they can identify an addiction long before, addictive personality long before they put alcohol into their body. I remember having this like insatiable need for attention. I just needed people's attention. And when I didn't get it, it was like if people didn't shine their light on me, I just, I wasn't okay. And I developed really early codependent relationships with people. Like if my mom wasn't okay, then I wasn't okay. And I didn't really know how to have my own feelings. It's like I'd look to someone else and be like, oh, it's okay? Oh, okay, then it's okay. And they'd be like, oh, we're gonna be upset? Oh, fuck, okay, we're upset. But I didn't know how to do that on my own, you know? I was just so codependent. And it's something, honestly, that I struggle with to this day. I struggle with it with my sponsor. I struggle with it with my mom. I struggle with it with people I put on a pedestal, you know, and I look up to people in my life and I create that codependent bond. It's, I think because it was my earliest issue, it's been the one that's one of the hardest to really break free from. But anyway, I mean, you know, I don't want to spend a whole lot of time about what, it was like, what I was like. I grew up like a lot of people. I had a fairly normal home. It was my I would consider my mom an alcoholic now, but she didn't really drink at the time. I don't know. I just the first time I drank, I remember I just really liked it. But I immediately lost control that first time. You know, some people can remember their first time, and or some people can't remember their first time, which I think is crazy. You know, not because they got blackout, but because they just, like, it was such a non-issue that they don't think about it. And I'm like, well, that's just crazy. Of course, I remember my first time. I remember what it was. I remember, I probably, if I thought hard enough, could remember what I was wearing. I remember exactly where I was and whose house I was at and what we did. I even remember the question that the mom in the car who was driving asked me, and I got wrong. And at that point, I was like, wow, I think I'm drunk. You know, she asked me if my boyfriend's, what my boyfriend's baby's name was going to be. That came out wrong. Rewind. My boyfriend's dad's baby was going to be, got remarried and they were having a kid. Anyway, I said July, which was the due date, and I just remember it was like immediate. That was what I said because it was the first thing that came out of my mouth and came into my head, and I remember thinking, that's not right, you know, and I was like, I think I'm drunk, you know, and it was a love affair, you know, and when you're in high school, at least for me, I didn't get a lot of chances to drink, but when I did, I drank to excess, and I'm a blackout drinker. I started blacking out probably like the third time that I drank and blacked out right up until the very end. And had some pretty crazy experiences with that. For a long time in AA, I used to have this huge chip on my shoulder. Like, you know, people were like, well, I never blacked out. I'm like, well, you can just get out. And then come to learn that's like a serious character defect. And I struggle with major ego problems around that. That everyone that sits in these seats has earned their seat. And that it's not about what you drank or how you drank or, you know, what you put in your arms or up your nose. That it's about that hopeless condition of mind and body. And that's what it really took to. When I was brought to my knees, what brought me to this program really was that hopelessness, that complete demoralization of just, I mean, utter, it's almost like there's no word. The only way I can explain it is if you know, you know. It's that sinking pit of your stomach, shame, I mean, demoralization is such a great word. Bob really picked a good word. Bob and Bill really picked good words when they selected. And Bill said in here, you know, complete demoralization and hopeless condition. That's what described it. You know, I was, at the very end, I was driving around in blackouts and hitting things. And, you know, I didn't know what I hit. And I'd have to be like, oh, is there blood on the car? Like, did I hit a person? You know, my car's totaled in the parking lot, but, you know, I don't even know what I hit. And someone just mentioned, they were like, yeah, I said something about how when I was drinking, I couldn't control my bladder because I'd have to go to the bathroom so fast. I'd pull my pants down and my cell phone would be in my back pocket and it'd just go plop right into the toilet, you know? And someone was like, yeah, well, this one time I peed the bed. I'm like, oh, one time. God, that was like, literally, it's what I did for like 3.5 years in college. And I swear to God, I did some serious work to be able to stand up here and tell you guys that without any, like, without wanting to just, like, crawl back in there and just cry. I'm sure my husband probably wants to leave and he's embarrassed. But I'm not embarrassed anymore, you know, because it was just, like, I even went to, this is the depth of the denial, I even went to a urologist when I was in college and was like, I think something's wrong with me. And no one at the time was like, no, you are an alcoholic. You're drinking so much that your brain will not wake up your body so you can physically relieve yourself. And I would just continually pee in the bed. And it actually took a great therapist that I had at Ridgeview to do a lot of work around that shame, because for a long time, that shame really eats you alive. And that shame is a big part of what brought me to my knees and brought me here, was the shame of looking at someone else and being like, oh my God, I can't believe this happened again. You know, I can't believe that this is going on in my life. And then 6 hours later, picking up another drink because we can't remember what it was like 6 hours ago when I woke up in a puddle of my own urine and I was ready to go again, because that's alcoholism at its best. Also, and this is a plug to, I'm going to get to the solution, but this is a plug to people who struggle with eating disorders. I had a massive problem with bulimia for a very long time. And I think it's something that, you know, we talk about, and this talks a little bit about how we, you know, what we do a lot of times with our drinking and then on into our sobriety, which is part of my story as well, is we look for outside things to fill up inside, something that only God can do, only our higher power can do. And we're constantly looking for things to fill us up. Other people, you know, relationships, money. I mean, the first and most obvious thing, obviously, is alcohol and drugs. That's what gets us here. And in a way, I'm grateful that that's what got me here. Gambling, porn, whatever it is that people use, food that people use to fill up that hole. And for me, my eating disorder was one of those things. And I think that it happens a lot in these rooms that when people, before they get sober and then after, it's something that they reach to, you know, because it's just another thing that we can use to distance ourselves and block ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. And it's got such a stigma around it. I remember at one point I'd be like, you know what, I would go up to anyone on the street and be like, yeah, I stuck a needle in my arm. But you want me to go up to someone and say I stuck my finger down my throat and I threw up my food? Fuck that, no. I'd much rather go tell them I stuck a needle up my arm. And it's like, really? That seems really odd to me. But that's the power of shame, you know? There's so much shame wrapped up with that particular, or there was for me, for that particular behavior. And it's just a plug that this program, these steps, my connection with my higher power, you know, it's not just, like I said, alcohol is but a symptom. And I've learned that anything that I try to fill up in that hole is doesn't work, and my eating disorder was one of them. So I don't know, I always encourage, you know, I know this isn't an EDA meeting, but it's part of my story, and so, you know, this is part of my truth, just like drugs are part of other people's story as well. It's a conversation I think that people don't have enough, and that, you know, this, there is a solution, and this is the solution. So, anyway, I got, you know, through a couple of serious, you know, big things happened in my life. You know, once you graduate, if you've been there, you guys are all so young. I graduated college and everyone else, like, stopped drinking and blacking out, and I continued, and that's when it kind of got like, oh, this might be an issue. And it was at that point that it became more apparent to everyone else what had already become apparent to me, that I had a problem, and led me into a treatment facility. What really happened was I met someone that I consider to be, like, pretty much my soulmate. And I was like, okay, he was like, this is it. I can't deal with you, drunk. So I'm gonna leave. You know, I know that we think that we're meant to be together and we're gonna get married, but I can't do this. And I'm like, all right, if I can stop for anyone, I can stop for you. Like, 4 days later, I was like driving around Atlanta, wasted, high, lost in my own city that I'd grown up in since I was, you know, a baby. And that just, I mean, no human power. That I didn't need to prove it to myself, but I did. No human power can help us. So I got hooked up with some power. And actually, it took me a little while to get hooked up with the kind of power that I'm hooked into now. I spent the first couple years of my sobriety kind of just going along, going through the motions, going to meetings, kind of hanging out, having a good time. My sponsor was like my best friend. I don't discount everything that we went through, but I think that she served a purpose in my life, but and that was probably, she was there for a reason, but you know, when you're not doing the work, when you're just kind of floating along, it will become very obvious to you very soon that that these promises are not coming true in your life, and something will happen, and what I'm sure is talked about in here a lot will occur, and the spiritual malady will manifest in your life, and it manifests in different ways. And they talk about, you know, on page 52, the people call them the bedevilments, in different ways. You know, are you discontent? Are you unhappy? Are you depressed? Different things started happening in my life in sobriety. So I'd spent 3.5 years sober, and you know, fine. I didn't really do any prayer or meditation. I didn't have a real relationship with my higher power. I didn't really understand what that relationship was going to look like, nor did I necessarily have the willingness to pursue it. And a bunch of great things were happening in my life. I was getting married. I moved up here from Nashville, graduated law school, started a new job. It's like, on the outside, you should be super happy. And on the inside, I wanted to die. I got really, really depressed. And I didn't know why. You know, I thought when you got sober, rainbows and butterflies, you know? And I was like, where the fuck are my rainbows and butterflies? You know? What's going on? There weren't any rainbows and butterflies, and I was pissed. I felt like I got, you know, like sold the short end of the stick. I'm like, can't, you know, I can't drink alcohol. I can't do drugs. Can't like binge eat food. At the time I wasn't smoking. I'm like, can't smoke cigarettes. I'm like, ugh, this is worse, you know? And I just had literally no solution. And I went and I heard a really good friend of mine tell his story. And he talked about the spiritual experience that he had. And he talked about developing a relationship with his higher power and going through these steps in a way that I'd never, ever heard before. And as he's talking, and he's an incredible speaker, as he's talking, tears are rolling in my face, and I don't even really realize it. I'm just watching him and crying, and he's probably telling a story, being like, "What the hell is wrong with Jackie?" And afterwards, I go up to him, and he's like, "Obviously, something's wrong. Are you okay? What's going on? Like, let's come, you know, come over here and let's talk." And I was like, "You know, I don't know what's going on with me. I'm unhappy. All these things are happening." And he was like, "Well, how many meetings are you going to? You know, are you doing an evening review? Like, how, you know, are you doing this? Are you doing that?" And I'm like, "Whoa, I don't even understand half of what you just said, you know?" And he was like, "Well, that might be a problem right there. You know, that might be something you need to fix." And he was like, "All right, I got someone that I want you to talk to, and it's very intense. He's a very intense guy, and are you sure you're ready for this?" And I'm like, "Yes, bring it. You know, I'm definitely ready." And looking back at that moment now, I'm like, "Ooh, was I really ready?" But because there have been times that have been like, "I don't know." But at that moment, that next day, he was like, "You go home." I felt like I was a newcomer again. He was like, "You go home. Here's his number. You call him tomorrow." And I'm like, "Okay, here's his number. Call him tomorrow. Got it." You know, it was just like being like one day sober again and being needing someone to tell me exactly what to do. And that launched me on this journey that I've been on for about, I don't know, I guess a year or so now. Of probably the most uncomfortable journey I've ever been on, to be honest. But I've learned that when I am uncomfortable, I'm growing. So the growth that I've experienced in this past year has hopefully been a lot. And we started going through the steps, and I learned some really great things. One of the things that I learned that I've really connected with is that my first step experience is what carries me through all the other steps. And that really has resonated with me. It did at the time, but more so now that I'm later in the steps. You know, when we're in that moment and we're, you know, 2 days out of a drink and we feel like death and we've got, you know, cuts on our wrists still healing, and we've got our car, I mean, this is me, I've got cuts on my wrists still healing, I've got, you know, the ridiculous note that I've left Jamie, you know, scrawled in blue eyeliner in the trash, I've got my car totaled out front, I've got this wreckage of a life, it's really easy to be like, okay, I'm willing to do anything, let's do it, I want to do it. When you get 60 days, 3 months, 6 months out from that, and things get better, it's hard to reconnect with that. But if we don't reconnect with that, if we don't remember that, if I don't remember that, for me, literally to drink is to die. And I have one sponsee that I work with that is like, "Well, it's a little bit hard for me to go straight there to drink is to die." She's very like literal with her thinking. And I'm like, "Well, I understand that, you know, it's not like take a drink, you're going to die right away, but play the tape through." And it's very easy for me to play the tape through. I don't even think I'd take a drink first, actually. I think the way it would work is I'd probably like be real sneaky and start taking pills and be like, "Oh, I can definitely get it." Because once I start drinking, it's like everyone knows I'm drunk. But I'm pretty sure, you know, if I do some cocaine or I take a bunch of, I used to snort like pretty much anything I can get my hands on, but Ambien. Used to snort Ambien. Like, I'm pretty sure that I could, yeah. What? pretty pretty sure that I could, you know, convince myself that that would be the way to go first. And then it starts that demoralization, you know. And then I would drink eventually because that's where I go. And then I'd be driving and I'd kill someone or I'd cut my wrist too deep that one time that I'm in this, like, miserable blackout, cry for help or whatever. I'd die. That's where I go, you know. So for me to drink is to die. I don't really need a whole lot of that middle because it plays out fairly clearly in my mind. I've been there. And it might have been, you know, a couple years ago, but it can feel fairly recent at times. So when you're in that moment, it's pretty easy to stay connected with that. But as you're going through the work, that's what has to propel me through the work. When I get to step four and I'm doing an inventory, a ridiculous inventory that my sponsor has like 19 different sheets. And he's like, this is called Theater of the Lie and we're going to do this. And, you know, and I'm like, oh my God, there's so much writing. And it turns out to be one of the greatest experiences I've had. And I actually really connected with it. But at the time I'm like, I don't want to do this. Not only do I not want to look at my character defects, I sure shit don't want to like write a novel about each one and then, you know, dive into my part in any resentment, not just to say, oh yeah, I acknowledge my part, but to like really write out my part in it. But I connect back with to drink is to die. And that's why I do that. And that's what keeps me in the moment, because if I let go of that, then I'm just doing it just to do it. And I drag my feet. And actually, that was my experience. I started going through my four step with my sponsor, and I did drag my feet, and I was pretty miserable. I think I sat on it for like 4 months before I did it, maybe 5, 6. Alex is like, it was 6. It was a while, and it was pretty painful. But it takes what it takes. And then I think about, you know, going in and taking everything that I've written down and going in and doing a fifth step and telling it to someone else. Why would I want to do that? You know, I particularly remember at one point, and this is what's so important about doing a fifth step with someone, who's been there and has had an experience before, is, at one point during my fifth step, I was talking about something in my sex inventory and, my sponsor was like, so you're telling me that you had an affair with this guy and you slept with him and then you made it sound like he raped you in a blackout when everyone found out that you cheated on your boyfriend with him. And I was like, no, no, no. That's fucking awful. No. 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 It's not me. You know, 3 weeks later, I'm like, yeah, that's what happened. You know, it was a smack in the face. It really sucks to have someone sit in front of you and tell you the truth. But it's because they love me, and that's the only way that you're going to wake up to that stuff. And when I look at it now, I'm like, that is the truth. I was looking for a way out of that situation and looking for a way to be like, it was me. Like, I didn't do this. You know, I was wasted, which everyone can believe because I was such a freaking lush in college that it wasn't that hard to believe that Jackie was wasted and someone could take advantage of her. So if I nudged that a little bit, if I was a little bit manipulative with that and I let people's minds wander, so what? Does it matter that this kid, you know, walked around with that hanging over his head? Sure, it matters. Does it matter that I have to go fly up and make amends to him now? Yeah, that matters too. Which brings me to my other point. It's like, when you're going to make amends, why are you going to do that stuff if you don't remember that to drink is to die? You know? And amends can be such powerful experiences. A quick story about amends I just had. There's two funny stories, actually. I was about to make an amends, and I was telling my story about this amend. I was telling my story and told this piece of my amends at the Salvation Army, and the amends involves taking drugs from a animal hospital where I worked. And I didn't know what they were going to do, but I knew that they were the good drugs because they locked them up at night. And so I'd be like, oh, I'll take them back. And they'd be like, oh, thanks, Jackie. It's so helpful. You know, and I'd be like, take them back to the room. And I'd take a couple and I'd pop, you know, two or three or whatever. And the first time I actually took them, I took one at work and I had no idea what it was going to do to me. And it was just out of my mind at work. And, you know, when you look at it now, you're like, what are you thinking? But I needed to make a financial amends to the hospital, obviously, for stealing their drugs. And I happened to be, like, on good terms, thankfully, with the owner, so I was able to go back and do that. But before I made the amends, I told my story at the Salvation Army, and I had two different people come up to me and be like, did you ever think about making amends to the animals for taking their drugs? I did not think about that. And they were, like, totally serious, so I had to be like, well, I didn't take them from, like, specific, I didn't go in and wasn't like, oh, Fido's, you know, cancer medication. I'm going to take his. I took them from, like, the general drugs. So I don't feel the need to go apologize to, like, the specific animals or their owners, although that would be so horrible. I'm sure my sponsor would be like, oh, well, you got to go do it. But I did go make that amends, and that's not a generic dog name. That's not necessarily something I wanted to get up and go do on a Saturday morning either. You know, I didn't want to get up and go see someone. I still take my dog to this vet, and my dog's like my child because I don't have any children of my own. You know, I still take my dog to this vet. I didn't really feel like getting up Saturday morning early and like sitting for 20 minutes in meditation to go prepare myself to be like, listen, I stole a bunch of these, you know, Schedule 3 narcotics and I took them on the job and what do I owe you? But I mean, you know, a lot more than that, but I did because, to drink is to die. And not just that it's like every amends I make, I'm unblocking one more, I don't even know how to phrase it, one more block that was in the way of me having a relationship with my higher power. You know, doing the fourth step talks about, you know, illuminating, you know, the defects, illuminating the dark spots inside of us. And as most people know, illuminate means to, like, shed light on. And that means, like, unblocking what's inside of you from the sunlight of the spirit, from your higher power. And so that started for me in the fourth step and continued on in the fifth step with really having someone tell me my truth because I was unable to see it, you know, specifically with that one incident, with that sex relation, and seeing my manipulation, my part in that. I was unable to see that. And I couldn't see it for a couple more weeks until I was ready. But sitting with someone and being able to have them tell me the truth like that, and then being able to go to people and one thing someone told me recently about amends is, you know, try not to say I'm sorry. And when I first went through the steps, I was like, well, that's all I'm going to say. I'm going to be like, listen, sorry about this. I'm sorry I stole your car. I'm sorry I took all your money. I'm sorry about this. And I was at a retreat and someone was like, you know, you really shouldn't even just take I'm sorry out of it, you know. Just be like, I recognize where I'm at fault. I want to go back and make right this situation. How can I do that? This is my plan. If it's a financial amends, this is my plan for doing so. Would this be acceptable for you? It's about going back and like making right that wrong rather than just offering up, I'm sorry. You know, it's like taking action with that. And in doing that, it's like chipping away one more piece of whatever it is that blocks me off from my higher power. And that's that, and because I know that that's what keeps me from my higher power, and that to drink is to die, and not just to drink is to die, it's to do anything that keeps me separated from my higher power. So to binge and purge with my eating disorder, that is to die as well. And to take external things and use them to supplement what only my higher power can do. That's at the point at which someone, that's where I would die. You know, that's what it means for me. It's not just to drink is to die. That's the most obvious one for me. But when I get blocked off from that sunlight of the spirit, that's what that happens. On page 45 of We Agnostics, it says, lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how were we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself by which to solve your problem. For a long time, I thought this book was just about how to stop drinking. And if this book were just about how to stop drinking, I would be totally screwed, and I feel like a lot of people would too. There are a lot of people in the rooms that, or at least where I got sober in Tennessee, that were like, just put the plug in the jug, you know, just put down the drink and just keep coming back. And that's all well and good. Like, I don't think you should not keep coming back. Obviously, you should keep coming back. That's part of it. That's part of the fellowship. But this book isn't about stopping drinking. This is about how to live. It's how to get connected with a power greater than myself. And I was able to see the futility of putting power in other people and in myself through my own experience. And I think that if everyone can look back at their own experience, they'll be able to see that. I was able to see it through my own experience because I spent years in that hopeless state of demoralization with consequence after consequence after consequence, and I would still do the same thing. And luckily, none of them were, and I don't know, luckily, whatever, none of them were, you know, legal. I never got a DUI for whatever reason. I never landed in jail for whatever reason. But, you know, having my ego be so huge that, like, one night I said I was going to be the sober driver, and then I ended up getting drunk. But I didn't want anyone to know that I'd been drinking. So, because my pride, my ego, and so I said I would drive everyone home because I'm the sober driver. And I drove home me and this guy and this 8-month pregnant woman. And I think about it now and I'm like, God, you were so fucked up. 8-month pregnant, you know, and it's just like the shame after that, when I sobered up the next day, the shame that accompanies that demoralization, you know, that's the kind of stuff that brought me to my knees. And then to have someone, then me to put all my faith in someone else, me to find someone that I thought could cure me. You know, I found someone else that I was like, oh, if I can get sober for anyone, I can get it sober for this person. And then to go out not 4 days later and find myself wasted, drunk, wandering around Atlanta in my car, literally lost in Virginia Highlands. Obviously forget where I was. I had no idea in the first place. You know, I was able to prove to myself something that I think sometimes we have to prove to ourselves, that lack of power. That's my dilemma. That was my dilemma. I had no power in my life. And it's through this work that I've gotten hooked up with the power. It's also through this work, I just talked about ego just then, that I've gotten really hooked up with something that I started, an awareness that I started to become familiar with and when I was doing some work with a therapist in Nashville, and I've really gotten some more clarity around it here in Atlanta. But a lot of people talk about, you know, different stage characters. Like in the big book, people, the way that the Bill has a lot of things structured is around, you know, Shakespearean and plays and, you know, the actor in the show. And when people do 4 steps, or sometimes they look at different character defects, they think about stage characters, and this stage character over here. And like I mentioned earlier, like I had an AA stage character that was like, oh, you didn't black out, then get the fuck out, you know? Like that stage character that thinks that they're just all that. That's a stage character. Well, for a long time before I knew, really was like familiar with that term, I called it my committee, you know, and it was like my committee that sat in my head. And it was a really helpful way for me to think about the ego and how crafty and manipulative and, as someone said last night, multifaceted the ego is. There are a bunch of different members that, if you can visualize it, that sit up in my head, and they're committee members, and they each have, like, a role. Like, I've got one that's addicted to sugar, and my therapist at the time that I worked for like, 4 years, he was like, I can literally, like, if we start talking about candy, he's like, you literally physically change. He's like, your eyes get brighter, your voice gets, like, perks up a little bit. Like, he's like, it's fucking weird. Like, you physically change. And I can almost feel it when it's happening because my committee member takes over and I'm like, ooh, candy? Like, yes, let's talk about candy. But I know it's my committee member, you know? And then I've got the committee member that thinks that, you know, they're the super koye because, like, I know what a blackout is more than any other person's ever blacked out ever, you know? And it's like, please, you know, sit down. And then the good thing about that I didn't realize until a little bit later in sobriety was that the ego is I used to think for a long time that the ego was just thinking very highly of myself. So I only had half of my committee. The other half of my committee is the other half of the ego, and it's the ego that thinks that I'm a piece of shit. That's the ego as well. You know, a lot of times we think of the ego as just this grandiose, you know, part of ourselves that thinks that we're better than. Your ego is just as much there when you're thinking that you are less than as well. And so when I realized that, I'm like, oh God, that brings in like 9 more people on the committee that thinks that I'm, you know, fat and ugly and stupid and less than. And really when you think about it, it's like with all those people, I'm all I think about all the time. Whether I think about good stuff or bad stuff, it's all about me, all the time. And in getting hooked up with a network and getting some time to spend in prayer and meditation where you can quiet your mind, which is really, really difficult. Someone told me recently that to be like a meditation guru, if you can spend like 3 seconds with 0 thoughts, then you're like the highest of the high on the meditation level. And I was like, that's amazing. 3 seconds, that's nothing. And if that's like the top of the top, then I don't feel so bad that I'd spend no time. I mean, it's easier for me if I do like mantras. Like in the car, I was just doing one that was like, God's will in, self will out. But I wouldn't recommend that one because sometimes I'll be like, self will in. And I'm like, oh shit, no, it's God will in, God will in. It's easier if you're like, God's will in, Jackie's will out, because then it's like a little bit more of a contrast. But having that prayer meditation to keep that strength of your higher power in place, and also having a network of people who love you enough to tell you the truth. I had someone that, I'll always remember this person, we're not friends now, but she was the first person in my life, and I went back and I made amends to her for some stuff that I did in our relationship. But she was the first person ever, and we were pretty young when she did it. I think the rest of my friends, I mean, I love them and I know they love me, but they were just kind of too young and immature to really do this. But we were in college, and she turned around to me one day and she goes, Jackie, when's the last time you asked how I was doing? And I was like, I had nothing to say, because it was about me all the time. It was either about how good things were going or how bad things were going. It was how this drama was going on or this drama was cooling off. You know, it was Jackie all the time. And she couldn't be my friend anymore. She's like, I can't remember the last time you've asked about me. And I don't know a lot of people who have that much, self-care that she did at that time. To really step in and be like, listen, I've got to step back from this friendship. I can't do this. And I think about it now and I'm like, that was one of the first times I had with someone really telling me the truth, to my face. And luckily I've been hooked in with some people, since then that, told me the truth all the time. And, And as uncomfortable as that is, you know, I said when I started this journey that it's been really uncomfortable. You know, when I'm comfortable, I'm not changing. I'm not growing. It's really easy to be asleep. It's a lot harder at times to be awake to things, to be conscious of our character defects. You know, I'm really conscious of where I need work these days. You know, I still struggle with a lot of things. I'm continually working on my relationship with my higher power and developing it and trying to get closer to what I believe my higher power to be and evolving that. And it's a process. I just think that there's so much power to be had in these steps. I almost feel like I haven't like adequately explained it to my satisfaction. So hard. You're just like, I only have an hour, and you're like, oh, well, I didn't say this. I guess the other point I want to make before I close is a point about working with others. Working with others in my sobriety has taken on a completely new meaning for me in the past 6 months. And it's really changed the disciplines in my life, my daily disciplines. You know, if you asked me a year ago, am I getting up in the morning and praying and meditating and taking time for myself? Am I being of service to someone every day, you know, a couple times a week? Am I doing my part to carry this message? I'd be like, yeah. You know, I go to meetings. And even that probably wouldn't be true because I don't go to that many meetings. But taking on sponsees and taking them through the work is such an evolutionary process for my own sobriety, not to mention hopefully what it does for other people, but that's not really the point. You know, our primary purpose, as everyone knows, is to carry this message, and in doing so, I'm able to also chip away at that block that sits there that blocks me from my higher power. So, you know, in doing these things, in making my fourth step and going through my fifth step with someone that will tell me the truth, in making my eight-step list, and in continuing and going through with my nine-step amends, even the ones that, you know, some of the ones, I don't even think the animal hospital one was that big of a deal. The one where I have to go up to Virginia and track down this guy that I mentioned and you know, make an amends to him and pay for his medical bill because my boyfriend at the time got in a fight with him and he got stitches. So I would have never thought with that. My sponsor was like, oh, that's a financial amend. I'm like, oh, my God, where do you get this? But it is. Yeah, that's the stuff I'm not necessarily looking forward to, but I know that it is an essential part of chipping away at that block, and that if I don't do it, I'm going to stay stuck. And I know what it feels like to stay stuck, because I was there not that long ago. And it was, if I think this is uncomfortable, it was much more uncomfortable in a completely different way. I'm not sure how long I'm supposed to talk. It's 5 till. So I think I'll wrap it up with that. I just appreciate the time, and I appreciate everyone listening. Thanks.
Thank you, Jackie. Let's give her another hand.